Hi, Eli.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm good. It's the eve of July 4th, one of my favorite holidays.
And you're working not only for your actual employer, Newsbeast, but
I'm working for News. I may get some calls, but I think we'll be okay.
Okay, and I'm happy to assist you in any tasks that should come up. And you're joining us on kind of short notice, thank you, because a lot is happening. So much is happening in the world. A coup in Egypt, just to take one example, that was.
Yeah.
Is there any other word for it? Some people are claiming so, but I don't think so, right?
Well, it'll be interesting because, you know, my sense is that the, you know, Obama administration doesn't want to call it a coup, because if they call it a coup, then at that point they're legally bound, I think, to stop giving the military.
Is that right?
Aid. Yeah, so there's actually an important question of what exactly it is, though I think for plain English purposes it is a coup.
So there's actual legislation constraining them in that way? When did that happen? I missed that.
I don't know what the origin of the legislation is, but you're not allowed to give aid to a military that has deposed an elected government, which is... So it, calling it a coup from the U.S. government perspective would have significant consequences, although the 2013 money for this year, we've already given the Egyptian military, so it would affect next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a lot can happen between now and then.
Oh, you could have two or three more coups, for example. Yeah.
Sure.
Now, we shouldn't spend too much time talking about things that could look silly or ill-informed in a matter of, you know, an hour or so, but that right now, I mean, I should say we're taping, like, immediately post-coup. It's
right.
Like the new regime just had its little TV moment about, you know, half an hour ago. And they were, you know, the military was joined by, you know, leaders of religious and political leaders of, I guess, a fair amount of diversity, although notably no one from the Muslim Brotherhood there. And the Muslim Brotherhood channel is black, apparently, and so are some other kind of conservative Islamic channels, I guess, TV channels.
I think there was a tweet from Morsi, or his whoever is running his Twitter account, denouncing the coup and as an assault on the elected government.
But calling for calm, not calling for armed insurrection.
No, at this point.
So what is your – do you have a sense for whether this is going to – go smoothly?
I'm wary of making any significant predictions, but I think it's safe to say it hasn't gone smoothly now. I mean, so I don't know that there. I think
as coups go, right? I mean, they didn't have to kill him. They, you know, they had arranged to, you know, they've got the communications reasonably well under control, with the exception of the fact that they don't control his Twitter account, which I don't think they're probably capable of in any fine, you know, I don't know. I imagine Twitter makes it pretty hard for somebody other than you to seize your account. But you know, I mean, as coups go, so far it's been relatively bloodless is what I mean. It seems like they've thought some of this through, that, you know, they had the little parade of leaders, you know, behind them and so on. So, I don't know.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I, as a journalist, I hate just posing questions and not knowing things, but I would just start by saying, well, it appears that the military went ahead and did this over the objections of the United States. So there's that. At least that's what we were being told yesterday, was the message to the military was, you know, you can't do a coup. You can't upset, unseat an elected government. The tone at the State Department today was critical of Morsi, saying that he did not do enough in his statement last night, but it then called for dialogue and for the parties to get together and work them out, you know, on their own. And certainly, you know, Jen Psaki, the spokeswoman a few hours ago, did not in any way give the impression that the U.S. was sanctioning any kind of coup, and she didn't acknowledge it either, although, you know, as more information comes in, that looks like what happened. And then finally, there's the question of, well, what will become of the Muslim Brotherhood? Would they participate in the next elections? If they don't participate in politics, will they revert back to what we saw in the Muslim Brotherhood in the early 20th century, when they were considered by the state to be a terrorist organization? something that, you know, we thought were kind of behind them. I'm not saying that that is going to happen, but that is an open question at this point.
But and it is one problem that people who worry about this coup have raised is the message it sends in general to Islamists around the world who have chosen to participate in a democratic political system or are thinking about participating. Or, you know, it's arguably not a good message to send, right?
Well, yes. I think that the U.S. is going to get blamed, is being blamed for everything. I mean, the protesters who were against Morsi had photographs of Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador, and Barack Obama with X's over their faces. The Muslim Brotherhood has blamed the United States for, you know, secretly allowing, you know, and kind of creating this crisis. I'm sure the U.S. will be blamed for allowing the military that it subsidizes to, you know, $1.3 billion a year to unseat an elected government. It's a lose-lose situation, and I think it's we could say it's partly because Obama has taken a fairly hands-off approach in some ways to you know, Egypt's transition to democracy, pretty much, you know, not criticizing or pressuring Morsi as he did a series of provocative things that I think angered you know, even other Islamists at this point.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, where was your heart on this one? If your professional identity allows you to disclose that, I mean, did you, you know, on Twitter, people are kind of taking sides, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I it's way too soon to take sides. I mean, I think that on the one hand, and this is not going to probably satisfy the blogging head's desire for strong dialectic, but on the one hand, I think that, the optimism from some analysts in 2011 and 2010 that the Muslim Brotherhood would moderate upon getting power was wrong. And I think that Morsi and particularly his party was consolidating power in a way. And there was a serious danger. It wasn't hypothetical that you were going to see a Muslim Brotherhood Mubarak, which is to say a president for life, but one that would be more ideologically driven by political Islam. On the other hand, I think that we had an opportunity to allow this elected government to run its course, and hopefully the ideal would be for it to be rejected in the polls so that you would have, you know, successive elections. So this is actually pretty terrible in some ways, in the sense that, you know, you don't have to agree with the Muslim Brotherhood agenda for Egypt and all kinds of things, but it would have been much better, I think, for everyone's interest for them to lose power through the ballot box. Though it's, I think, a legitimately open question as to whether the Muslim Brotherhood would have allowed truly free and fair elections again. So that's a muddled thought.
Well, that's a question for me. In general, you referred to his consolidation of power. To me, a critical question as far as which side of this I'm on, kind of sentimentally, is to what extent had he amassed power in an extra-legal or extra-constitutional way? Now, there was a time a while ago where he suspended the authority of the courts and kind of rushed a referendum on a constitution, and that was highly dubious. But I honestly don't know, and you may better than I, that since then, since they at least wound up with an approved constitution, how has he behaved himself? I don't mean as a politician, but to what extent has he done kind of extra legal things, or to what extent have there been clear, you know, amassings of power that should have filled us with foreboding?
The one thing that I think is really troubling, and the highest profile case was the Egyptian equivalent of John Stewart, was prosecuted under this law that you can't insult the Egyptian president. And there were many others as well who were prosecuted under that law. This was...
But that's a law. That's an actual law, right?
Well, yeah, but I'm saying when you use that kind of thing, it is using the power, the full power of the courts, to punish people who are, I think, legitimately criticizing you, and that is a way of that is a serious kind of political chilling effect on ability for them to have a free and open debate. So I think that was extremely troubling, and obviously, I'm attuned to that as somebody who lived in Egypt and also who, as a journalist, I have some solidarity with people who are, you know, basically prosecuted for being critical of the president.
Right. Yeah. But what that says to me is it's a democracy, but not a very liberal democracy. And, you know, it's any country is free to choose to have a democracy, but not a very liberal one, so far as I'm concerned. I mean, they're not the values I would choose, but I mean,
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's. I think it's.
No, but I guess my question is: look, a coup is totally extra legal, extra constitutional, and to me, the only justification for it is if the person being deposed had himself been doing things that fall in exactly that same category in a very troubling way. Okay, extra legal, extra constitutional. The earlier shenanigans before the constitutional referendum fall in that category. I'm just wondering: has there been stuff since then that he's guilty of that you know would justify this kind of thing?
Well, I'm with you in that I think but as I understand it, and it's a fast moving situation, so I think that the justification for the military was that you saw unprecedented millions of people in the streets. They needed to restore public order. The way that they'd restored public order was to remove the man millions of people were protesting from. It's very problematic when you have the military kind of taking on and removing an elected government on behalf of their understanding of sort of public safety. But in this particular case, it was unprecedented. I think the BBC said it was the largest protest in human history.
Yeah, although, you know, I was wondering about this. I mean, it seems to me that technology has made it much easier to get crowds out, right? So kind of to judge by historical standards, to judge... You know, 10, 20 years ago, this would have seemed totally epic to have this. In other words, 20 years ago, a crowd this size would have meant that the Egyptian people are almost unanimous in rejecting the president. That's the only way you could have gotten a crowd this large at. Now, you know, with Twitter and email and everything else, it's easier to generate a crowd. And so it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing. And it's particularly interesting in this case where the part of the population that has mastered the technologies of crowd generation is the part of the population that doesn't like this guy, whereas his supporters are probably, you know, less immersed in Twitter, Facebook, and so on.
I'm not so sure about that. The Muslim Brotherhood is very, very savvy in terms of social media. I mean, they have people who do it for them. I think if you're talking about the sort of core supporters, I would probably agree with you that they get people from the lower classes who maybe don't have access to computers or are not wired and don't have mobile devices and things like that. But the organization itself is pretty good at getting the message out, as we, you know, as Morsi's Twitter account attests.
So I don't know. What about?
I mean, I also think that like there was a demand for election. I mean, in the background there is this concern that, you know, Morsi would never agree to elections. I'm not justifying it, but I mean, he could have agreed to a certain extent to have these elections when, you know, you saw, you know, major figures in his government, like his foreign minister resigning and so forth. Mm-hmm. Could have said, okay, this is a political crisis. I have the power to have to have these elections. And then,
but does he really in the Constitution? I had read that he doesn't have the power to call early elections.
I think he did. I mean, that's my understanding, is that he could have supported it.
He certainly could have been more conciliatory in that address, and made gestures, and he didn't.
Right. And also, as you pointed out, in November, he did have, you know, the moment where he said, listen, I have unchecked executive authority. I can do whatever I want with this constitution. He walked that back, but that was also, I think, in the background, which is, I think that there was a sense from just talking to a few people I know in Egypt that, you know, if this guy isn't checked now, you know, we have him for life, so to speak. Yeah. I'm not trying to rationalize anything, because I agree with you that it's really troubling that with only a year into his the first elected presidency in Egypt, that there is this kind of coup. And we're reacting to it in real time. So I don't want to necessarily, I think it's important to try to, you know, get that context.
Yeah. And of course, you know, all of what we've been talking about aside, a large part of the impetus was economic here. And I don't see anybody solving their economic problems anytime soon, but maybe I'm missing something.
Well, that's the backdrop as well, is that the slogan of the Muslim Brotherhood is Islam is the solution, and it looks like Islam is not the solution right now for many of Egypt's very real problems.
It's interesting to compare how he handled this with how Erdogan handled it. Both of them, you know, there are a lot of parallels. Erdogan, I would not say, is technically an Islamist.
Yeah, he is.
Well, we could have that argument. But right. But anyway, they certainly, his party sympathizes with the Brotherhood and they see themselves as kin. But I was comparing Morsi and Erdogan of Turkey's reactions to protests. They both were fairly uncompromising. Worked out a lot better for Erdogan's. One obvious reason is that Erdogan, I think, enjoys considerable popular support. If there were an election held today, he'd probably win. And maybe that's the only the take-home lesson. But in retrospect, I've got to think Morsi is wishing he had been a little more conciliatory in his address. I don't know.
No, I mean his address was like, "I'm ready to die," and you know it was doubling down in some ways.
I think maybe he thought he was in a bargaining situation, and the tougher he sounded, the more, you know, he didn't realize that they meant 48 hours.
Or maybe what he believed was that the legitimacy of the Egyptian presidency was at stake, and if he didn't, you know, say absolutely I will not be moved, then there was no point in being president anyway. I mean, well, I in some ways, if you're going to cow after they come out with a public 48-hour thing, then, you know, the presidency is weakened even if you survive and even if you remain in power.
Uh-huh.
Significantly weakened.
And it could be that he just, you know, kind of saw, in a way, the upshot of some of what we've been saying, which is that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is almost in a better position public relations-wise as a victim of a coup than it was going to be in if it continued to govern over disaster, which was really the alternative. And we'll see. You know, the game's not over. I mean, apparently, I don't know what he wants to do. He sounds like right now he does not want a violent insurgency on his behalf. At least that's what he's saying. But he doesn't want to fade away. We started to talk about the implications of this. You had said it turned out that the Brotherhood claims that it was that an Islamist government would be moderate had turned out to be unfounded. I don't know. Kind of yes and no. I mean, on the foreign policy front, for example, policy toward Israel was not radically overhauled, right?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, so that is one of the United States' main concerns. And, you know, I read somewhere, as far as Syria goes, that may figure into this, that one of the things that led the military to lose its patience with Morsi is his giving some sort of support to the more radical elements in the Syrian insurgency. Did you read this piece?
I haven't read that one. No.
But that the military, was impatient with that, which, you know, is, I don't know, does that make sense to you?
Listen, you have a situation now where also the minorities, the Coptic Christian minorities, are feeling incredibly under attack, and they feel that the state can't protect them. Is that entirely Morsi's fault? No, but does he bear some of the blame? I think so. And I think that in some ways, you know, it's an important moment in the sense that, you know, we had an assumption that the ideology itself was very popular. We had to deal with it. We had to deal with political Islam. There's kind of an inevitability to it in the region in general, and Egypt, of course, is a leading indicator. I don't know that that's the case. I think that political Islam and the Muslim Brotherhood, and I've said this on Blogging Hands, I think, you know, several years ago, you know, looks very good in comparison with corrupt authoritarian regimes. But once, you know, now that we've seen, you know, this point where they've had to actually try to govern, the choices that he made politically domestically suggested that he was not interested in really representing all Egyptians or the concerns of all Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I don't want to put this in the context of and therefore the coup is fine, because I don't think it is. But the point that our assumption when Obama goes to Cairo and addresses the Muslim world, that is adopting and purchasing the frame of the Islamists themselves. And it's baked in the assumption there that people identify themselves primarily by their religion in this part of the world. And I don't think we would do that for any other religion. And so maybe it's time to kind of rethink some of these assumptions in terms of how the United States and the U.S. president interacts with...
Well, yeah, but Eli, you consider the Turkish government Islamist, And there, I would say you've had a different story as far as the tolerance of religious diversity. You know, there are complaints to be made about...
Yeah, there are more journalists in jail in Turkey, I think.
Right, that's not religious diversity. I mean, we can talk about that, and we can talk about authoritarianism, if you want. But you were just now talking about whether an Islamist government will, in fact, respect religious diversity. And in the case of Turkey so far, I don't see any serious threats so far to that. And in fact, if you look at the grievances of the protesters in Turkey, you know, whenever every article would... about this, when first they talk about Erdogan's kind of obnoxiously arrogant attitude, which is, I think, an accurate characterization, and then they list specific grievances, and it was always like dinky stuff. I'm sorry, it was like they're closing liquor stores at 10 p.m. Well, there are places in America where you can't buy liquor 24 hours a day. Okay, I mean that's just not that's not the same as making Christians or Jews feel persecuted, right? And so I think if you're going to claim...
It's a precious distinction, I think. I mean, I think that there's dissatisfaction. You know, I'm not in Turkey right now, so it's hard for me to really... I don't want to get beyond what I know, but I would just say this. The issue is, will Islamists use elections and democratic elections as the one stop to ultimately consolidate power and have Islamic rule of some kind in their countries? And can ultimately Islamists, as Tariq Ramadan has told us, be compatible with democratic, liberal, open societies? And I don't think we can say confidently by any stretch that that's true. In fact, I think it's not true. And I think that the experience of Morsi and Erdogan in their authoritarianism, which is why it's relevant, in my view, it basically suggests that the grand bargain or the hope that we have that we can have Islamist parties presiding over open societies is maybe a false hope.
Okay, but I would say, you know, I've become, you know, the last few weeks have made me less of an Erdogan fan than I ever was. But I would say, just to kind of be clear about this, first of all, I would distinguish between authoritarianism, and I don't think Erdogan, by historical Turkish standards, is any more authoritarian than what was the norm for the 50 years preceding him, okay? Secondly, on the journalist thing, there's an irony here. Okay, first of all, I don't think any journalists have been thrown in jail to speak of in the last year, but there was a spate of that. There's an irony. There were two categories of journalists who I think were leading the pack for getting thrown into jail. One were those perceived to be supporting the Kurdish insurgency, and Erdogan may be bringing that to resolution, which would, I guess, be to his credit. But the other thing is, journalists thought to be in cahoots with generals who supposedly continued to pose the threat of a coup. You know, the great irony of Erdogan is that, on the one hand, he does show authoritarian tendencies of a certain type. I don't deny that. But he has played a big role in taking democracy to a new level in Turkey, in the sense of insulating it from the threat of a coup. Don't you think so? It's during his reign that a coup has become inconceivable.
Military coups, and I don't know, there's something like, yes, there were a number of these military coups in modern Turkish history. And he quickly, you know, sort of defanged and I think jailed in some cases the generals that he believed were a threat to him. And there is that historical context that you have to consider, but at the same time, I mean, I think his critics would say he's politicized the military. And
you want to politicize the military in the sense of the military being subject to civilian political control, right? That's good.
Yes, I agree. And, you're kind of putting me in this weird position because I don't want to, you know, it's hard for me to kind of take a strong position on this, but I do feel pretty strongly that, there was too much faith, especially in the first term of Obama and continuing in the ability to kind of have an understanding and working with political Islam. When I think political Islam is interested in democracy and interested in liberal institutions only insofar as it can help them kind of achieve power. And we have to at some point face the fact that that their views are incompatible with our views on any number of issues, and Israel's only one of them.
Well, wait, and, but their views on Israel turned out not to be incompatible with ours in the case of Egypt.
Well, Erdogan is a different story in the case of Egypt, although, and in the case of Morsi, what I think what we saw was a deal that the Israelis had with the Egyptian military to a certain extent, and Morsi himself decided at this was not the moment to challenge the Camp David Accord. And he was helpful, or he used his offices and instructed his government to try to get Hamas back in the box in November after the brief skirmish. Does that count as a war? What happened after the elections in November between Hamas and Israel? But you know, they are playing a long game, and I think it's well worth talking to Coptic Christian minorities in Egypt and others there are lots of people who are fleeing Egypt because they are afraid of this kind of takeover, and I don't think that those fears are totally unjustified.
No, I think one of Morsi's more disappointing features was his failure to do a couple of things that would have been easy to do. I don't know if they would have caused political problems, but just gestures, overtures about the inclusion of Copts, for example. That he just failed to make, and I agree that was a failing. But I don't think you see that kind of thing in Turkey, and you know you might not see it next time an Islamist regime comes to power democratically. If that happens, it's one reason I wish that if this government was going to lose power, it had lost power democratically.
Well, we all wish that. I mean, I absolutely agree. Yeah. It would have been much better for them to lose power democratically, and that would have been good for the Muslim Brotherhood because it would have made them – that would be the last step. They would, and it would really – people who were skeptical and worried could say, well, they relinquished power democratically. And that was the last – that was the one pregnant question or the most important – one of the most important pregnant questions. And we won't see that opportunity.
And if the post-mortem showed that they should have been more protective of religious minorities, then maybe that would be a take-home lesson that other Islamists would adopt. Whereas now they can say, well, we were victims, you know.
And, they will probably say that they were victims.
Of course they will. They are in some sense victims of a military coup.
Right, and looking at the trends in the Egyptian economy, it doesn't look like the next government's going to do much better on it.
No, it doesn't. Do you? I wouldn't mind talking a little about Edward Snowden.
I would love to. Yeah, that's what I've been actually spending most. I did this story on Obama's, kind of policy towards Morsi, but I've been focused a lot on the NSA issue. Yeah.
Throw out any conjecture, opinion, or finding on that subject.
Well, I'm, I've been convinced of this for a long time, but I think that this story really drives home the national security state. A secret national security state is enormous. It's too big and it's out of control. I'm totally uncomfortable with the idea that it appears that the NSA is basically creating an ability to aggregate all of the data on an individual in a nanosecond of our modern kind of electronic lives, from, you know, not only our telephone calls, we focus on these certain, but like everything from like our banking statements to everything, to kind of create a dossier that can be very powerful and important in preventing terrorism. But it's an enormous power that I'm not entirely comfortable with the government having. I could probably be convinced of giving the U.S. government this authority in a temporary basis and checked every few years. But that's impossible if the basic outlines of this authority and the basic outlines of this capability are a state secret.
Exactly.
And so my view is that, I think it's still to be debated, and it's not really for me to tell you, you know, to say this is good and this is bad. But at the same time, I think it's awful that we would have, apparently there's more of this classified and secret interpretations of public law that, it's excessive secrecy at this point. And I would, if I could, make, I think, a point that's been lost, because I've seen that there have been some Republicans and conservatives who have taken sort of the view that Snowden is a traitor, which I don't think is constitutionally correct if you look at the only crime defined in the Constitution. And there has not been evidence yet that he has adhered to the enemy or made active war on the United States. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say it's a mid-20th century conservative insight that big organizations and big bureaucracies will always justify themselves and expand if not checked. That is doubly so, I think, for secret bureaucracies, which is what we have at this point. And I think there's this very strong conservative kind of Hayekian argument here that it's dangerous to have such an enormous secret national security bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. Now,
because I think that that will create the conditions for a permanent war on terror.
Well, and it seems to me that the one thing that is should be almost undeniable is like what you said, leaving aside the wisdom of the policies themselves.
Yeah.
In a democracy, they should have been subject to the evaluation of the people, which can only happen if you know about them, as you put it, in at least a broad outline kind of way. Now, can you flesh this out for us a little in the following sense? There's been, you know, defenders of the administration, some of them have said, well, we basically knew about all this all along. You're paying more attention to this than I am. Can you tell me what are kind of some of the biggest, most important things that we, in fact, did not know about?
Well, PRISM is the full extent of the NSA's ability to collect lots and lots of internet data. If you think about it, it's hard to figure out where the American internet starts and the rest of the internet ends. So that kind of collection. We didn't know the details of the procedures, for example, for what they call minimization, which is a euphemism for basically saying, well, we're going to over-collect, and then we're going to try to dispose of the data that we don't need. But mm-hmm. it looks like the NSA is trying to keep all of it, and they're building this huge facility in Utah to kind of sort through all this stuff and to look backwards in time when they get a piece of information. And, you know, for me, it raises, I mean, like, I just feel that we didn't, there's a lot of this that we didn't know. We didn't know it in black and white. We had it from, in some cases, from sources say, you know, there was a USA Today story that got into some of this stuff, but they had to retract that story after the phone companies sort of got them on a technicality. And it turns out USA Today was right all along. And, you know, and then you, when you have government officials like James Clapper saying what he called the least untruthful statement at the time in response to, there was, I think you can show that there was an active effort to conceal this information in
right.
some ways.
So
I, you know, maybe we did know some of it. Maybe, and certainly I was aware that the NSA, you know, there was informed speculation about what Wyden had been talking about, a secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, and he'd been going on about that. But we now know the full details of it, and I think that that's significant.
And this all this data that they want to keep for like a long, long period of time, does that include the content of some subset of my emails, like maybe emails involving foreign parties or something?
Well, that I don't know, but I would just say that if you were to have an email conversation with a foreign national, that there's no restriction on the NSA not reading the full email of the foreigner, except when they find out that you're on there, there is a procedure that they have to go through and so forth. But the thing is that it's all a kind of like, well, you should trust us. And then there's a secret FISA court that is basically created warrants that nobody thought the FISA court was created so you could authorize secret eavesdropping on people in the United States believed to be, you know, spies and saboteurs and such. It is now, you know, used to justify the wholesale kind of collection of, you know, what they call this metadata. It was never really designed for that. I think, you know, somebody should have said at some point, you know, are we okay with this? Can we have an open debate about basically these basic capabilities without getting into some of the real details? And I'm very skeptical of this line that we've heard that the terrorists have switched up their programs or something like that, and they're now aware of it. I mean, we've known that Osama bin Laden is aware of American electronic surveillance ever since he stopped using a satellite phone after reading about how the U.S. tapped it, knew about it, one of his phone calls to, his mother in the 1990s. So, you know, serious terrorists and obviously other foreign intelligence know that the U.S. is trying to read their mail. And they, you know, and why should that then be in the basic broadest sense a secret from the American people?
Yeah. Do you have any kind of guess of what's going to happen to Snowden? I mean, it seems to me his only two options that now are either Venezuela or if this this Bolivian, you know, air.
Well, he wasn't on the plane. I mean,
no, he wasn't on the plane. But I mean, I'm just wondering if, assuming that the details are correct, that Bolivia's president was denied access to airspace, and I've seen some claims to the contrary lately on the internet, but if that's what happened, I can almost imagine him getting pissed off enough to decide to grant asylum, you know, just in retaliation for being humiliated, right?
Well, there's that. He could get it, but one of the things you've heard is they have to physically be in the country to get the asylum process started.
But isn't that at the discretion of the country?
I don't know enough about the individual asylum laws, although I've written a little bit about kind of how the extradition process would work with
also,
Ecuador.
Also, I've got to think, if Evo Morales calls Snowden and says, trust me, you were good on this, you'll get asylum, I would think by far that's the best option Snowden would have. But
well, that's true. I would just say that he doesn't have a valid passport at this point, though.
Yeah, but aren't there way? I mean, like, couldn't you take a private jet that flies over the Arctic Circle or something and doesn't need clearance from any countries to use their airspace and blah, 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 and then you don't need a, you know, right? Then you just show up and the country welcomes you.
Well, I mean, it's all kind of possible, but it seems like he's losing. I mean, like, Snowden is kind of, you know, a lot of countries have come out and said that they wouldn't take him. Clearly, I mean, the story that I'm trying to chase down is, what is the U.S. threatening? What are they saying to countries to make sure that this doesn't get out of hand? Although,
with Ecuador, it's trade.
I guess with Ecuador, it would be trade. With Bolivia, I can tell you that there's very little leverage the United States would necessarily mm-hmm. have. But, you know, I think in some ways he's in too deep. I at this point have no reason not to take him at his word that he did this for what he believed to be noble reasons. Although it's troubling when you consider the fact that, you know, the specific story that he gave to the South China Morning Post about the IP addresses of computers that the NSA is spying on, I don't see how that serves the public interest, at least for the United States, in the same way that, you know, the FISA warrants and things like that have. You know, when I interviewed Glenn Greenwald last week, he said he probably would not have published that story. You know, but then again, that is more kind of traditional, you know, just harming the U.S. interest, because the Chinese spy, of course, on the United States and try to infiltrate U.S. networks, and that's, you know, I think Michael Hayden had this great phrase that espionage is a grown-up sport. It's an adult sport. Mm-hmm. You know, it is. So, you know, saying you're a whistleblower against espionage is bizarre. It's not, doesn't have the same moral weight as saying you're a whistleblower against unchecked surveillance authority and vacuum up, you know, the personal
fate of
America.
Yeah, but, you know, I could see a principled case for saying, I don't like the idea of my government, you know, going around accusing a bunch of countries of, you know, cyber whatever, when in fact we're doing the same thing. I can see an American citizen. In fact, I kind of feel that way myself. I think we should be as unhypocritical as possible. And so I can see a citizen thinking, you know, our citizens deserve to know that. And also, this business...
that's one area where I think everybody knew that the NSA was collecting on foreign nationals. I mean, that was never... Everybody knew that that's what they were doing. I mean, the issue was...
breaking into the, you know, the university computers in China and...
Bob, you don't think the Chinese government uses university computers for all kinds of statecraft? Come on. I'm just saying. I mean, like, it's China. Let's speak as adults here, you know.
I mean, I don't know. What kind of things do they do via universities? Why would they
I think they probably teach people, like, how to break into, like, you know, the CIPRNet and other U.S. classified systems in Chinese universities. And I don't think that they have the same appreciation in China for the separation between private institutions and public institutions.
What about what about the spying on our allies? I mean, you can say everybody does it, but I can see an American citizen... And I'm asking this question, why, especially in an age when it's so hard to keep a secret, and there's such a good chance that the spying you're doing will become known, like, what? How big was the upside of spying on our allies?
Well, I don't know enough of the information other than the fact that we did, but, I mean, I just say our allies spy on us, and we spy on our allies. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, it's embarrassing when it becomes public, and, you know, there's already been diplomatic damage in some ways that has been done by that. It's hardly like in the same category as of, the FISA warrant that the first FISA warrant from Verizon. Yeah. Or the Prism slides, or the minimization procedures.
No, it's not in that category.
I think there really is like a public interest that is served by those disclosures in terms of sparking a debate about limiting excessive secret power from the government, and talking about this new capability, which I think benefits our country. Whereas, blowing these operations, so to speak, or what the NSA says, blowing one of their platforms for collecting and so forth. Well, I mean, I think mainly what it does is just it weakens, it harms our national interest, and I don't see it really serving in the same way the public interest.
No, definitely is a whole different category, and it definitely muddies his case.
Doing it in Hong Kong and then Moscow
no,
and all that is kind of like, ugh.
In retrospect, he'd have a lot more public sympathy if he had stopped at Prism, etc.
However, I will say the following. Doubling back against my case, and I'm still recording because I'm frozen again. But I'm sorry about that. But if it's still is it still recording?
It's definitely I think your end is recording. Have I frozen up?
You have.
Okay, well go ahead and finish what you're going to say. It's about time for us to call it quits anyway. But you still seem to be recording. Yeah, certainly your voice. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, here's what I would say. It raises this important kind of question, which I had not thought about until this whole Snowden saga began, which is there is an expectation, or it's accepted in this country, that the NSA will try to voraciously, vacuum up all kinds of electronic information on everybody else in the world, but it is going to respect the privacy of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a realistic expectation to ask an organization to, especially when you have a kind of borderless internet, and you have ISPs that serve clients from all over the world and so forth, which is really kind of how we got into this pickle, so to speak, after 9/11. They wanted to basically monitor the calls, monitor the traffic that came through America's grid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, is it realistic to ask a government, a secret government institution, to read everybody else's email and then say, but you can't collect our email? I'm just asking it as a kind of thing. Is it like, I mean, I just think that A, I wonder if that's possible, and B, I am skeptical of the nature of big institutions, and I always think there will be mission creep. I always think, especially if they can do it in secret and it never really has to get public scrutiny, I don't think that the intelligence committees, for example, are very good at oversight. I wonder if it's realistic to say, well, you can read, the Chinese email, but you can't read ours.
That's a difficult problem. I think what we agree on is it's a question that should be decided through a democratic process, and you can't do that. Nobody has any idea what's going on.
By the way, I mean, my view is I would like to have the NSA, read government officials in China and find out what they're up to, but I want our privacy to be respected. But if that is not an actual option or a choice, well, I guess I would say, I mean, I think the intelligence community is just too big. And by the way, it's also, that's one of the reasons why you're going to keep having, I think, WikiLeaks-like disclosures, because there's just too many people who have these security clearances and access to all this information.
Yeah, I mean, the number of people that I heard the other day that have access to top secret, I think like a million people.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's crazy.
It's like almost like a new class of people that can see this secret information that makes them better informed. I think that also, by the way, the excessive secrecy befuddles the country in that it's very easy to influence a, important policy debate by selectively leaking intelligence or not disclosing things all because it's top secret. And I think, George W. Bush did it. I think Obama does it. I think presidents, the temptation is too great to, kind of control the debate and Americans, not getting information they probably should get. So I that's where I'm at.
Okay. So we close on a note of Concord.
I think we do, yeah. I think you, by the way, are going to come around. I think you're going to see the illiberalism of political Islam, too. And
I see some illiberalism. It isn't
it's
that.
It's a serious issue.
I see some illiberalism. I just don't know that I think the movements now identified as Islamist are not inherently deeply, deeply illiberalism, I would say. I think they're more they're more malleable than you might think. I think that about movements in general.
And
we don't need them to be just like us. They don't need to be just like us.
No, of course they don't. And there is a real benefit to, I think, kind of getting out of the, you know, not being responsible for dictatorships in the Middle East, not having those close relationships. I think it's almost an unnatural position for the United States, which is, I think, most Americans support, you know, the aspirations of people who want freer societies. So the deal with the Mubarak had some short-term benefits, but I think in the long term, it was not in keeping with our, you know, with the soul of our country, and I mean that. But I think that there, in some ways, is a double standard that I see sometimes with progressives, which is that you would never tolerate the kind of outrageous bigotries that you hear from leading Islamist figures, whether it's Yusuf al-Qaradawi or the deputy prime minister of Turkey just blamed the Gezi protests in his country on the diaspora of Jews. Things like that, when they would be said by a Christian fundamentalist, would, you know, everybody would sort of denounce it. And I think that, you know, at a certain point, we're going to have to come to terms with, it's not an accident, it's not a few bad apples. Political Islam has is arrayed against a lot of core values that I think liberals and conservatives in the West share.
I actually think American progressives have been quite anti-Erdogan. I don't think that's a good example of your double standard. I actually think most of them didn't know anything about Turkey until this happened, and they immediately did a good and evil thing.
I'm not talking about the. I'm talking about the. In the there, you know, I think that they're the progressives who cover this space, that the people who you know, are influential in the policy debate. But it was always kind of a throat clearing thing, and we have to understand that when Morsi says in moments of candor things about, you know, the Jews running the international media and so forth, it's not because he's playing necessarily to a crowd. I think it's because here's a guy who really does believe that, and that should give us pause. And I don't want to focus just on the Jewish issue, though the political Islam does seem to have a lot of animus towards Jews in Israel, but it's any number of these things where, you know, you look at what mainstream Islamists say about things like how to properly discipline your wife and so forth, and you're like, well, this has nothing to do with traditional progressive, or for that matter,
well, of course,
I mean, I think
not, but you know, I mean, just in general, I think you have to respect some limitations on our ability to remake the world in our image.
Yes.
And I say that as someone who thinks that in the long run, a lot of these values will tend to converge with what we would call modern liberal values in the long run. But I also think that trying to change them ourselves often retards that process.
I suppose I've evolved, because I would say there are limits to what you can do.
Yeah.
When you are coming out of a situation like in Egypt, where the U.S. for three decades was supporting the dictatorship, you have very little credibility to, you know, of support the groups that you would like to see, you'd like to advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a separate question about what American policy ought to be, which is not always the same as then this other question of, you know, I think, you know, there was a tendency in 2010 and also in 2011 to overlook the uglier side of the Muslim Brotherhood.
But I think there's also the question of whether just denouncing the stuff prominently does it help? B, does it actually possibly retard the process of you know, kind of progressive evolution?
I'll push back, and then we should go on. Am I recording here? Or are we?
I hope. You are. I mean, I'm pretty confident, but I worry that I may have been frozen for the last 12 minutes. So anyway, say one more thing, and I'll give you the last word.
Okay. I would say that what the president does or the secretary of state does is a separate question of what kind of progressive groups do and progressive just voices do. And I guess what I would say is that it's obvious to me that the Muslim Brotherhood craved for a while the support of, you know, kind of liberals and progressives in good standing in the West. And, you know, that, so those are two separate issues. That's all I would say, that, and that, you know, at a certain point, you know, they're not the real allies of progressives. And you can't, I mean, I think that, you know, at a certain point, progressives who are universalist or care about Egypt has to hope that the Muslim Brotherhood does not implement its agenda and has to try to eventually figure out a way, without involving the U.S. government, probably, to support those who are against them.
Okay. I promise to give you the last word.
Thank you.
And I'm as good as my word.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
A lot of fun.